The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce An Chee Min. 20 years ago, she made her literary debut with Red Azalea, a memoir of growing up in China during the violent trauma of the Cultural Revolution. The book was an international success, and in direct and frightening prose, it laid bare her systematically deprived childhood. A member of the Red Guard by the age of 9, she was sent at 17 to a labor farm with backbreaking work days and heartbreaking nights until talent scouts recruited her to compete for a starring role in the film of Madame Mao's opera Red Azalea. A New York Times reviewer writes that her prose style is inspired by the didactic operas and films of Madame Mao, the only permissible art in China during her youth. And she has developed it into an instrument with remarkable range, full of sorrow and humor, sometimes appealingly coarse and sometimes nuanced. Now she bravely returns to the story of her own life to give us the next chapter. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming An Chee Min.
Hello, hello. Thank you. So wonderful to be back. How are you? Good to see you. Good to see you. I had a special preparation for tonight's presentation because as I go with all these books, I often find people sleeping in my face. 7:30 is the best slot because you had a dinner and you're tired, and some of them you worked the whole day. You're just gonna, if I mumble, and I just think it's, can I do better? I'm American now, I should be more creative. And that's what this country is known for. So I get a bit creative here. So I made all these things, and I hope that it will work, that you won't fall asleep. But if you do fall asleep, you can always make suggestions and tell me how to do better. Before I start, what do I say? Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing. The title of the book, The Cooked Seed, means... Wait a minute. Let me just read you. So, the date was August 1st, 1984. It was China's midnight and America's morning. I was about to drop out of the sky and land in Chicago. What made me scared and nervous was that I didn't speak English and had no money. The $500 I had folded in my wallet was borrowed. But I could not let myself be frightened. I was 27 years old and life had ended for me in China. I was Madame Mao's trash, 四人帮的残渣余孽, which meant that I wasn't worth a spit. For 8 years, I had worked menial jobs at the Shanghai Film Studio. I was considered a cooked seed, no chance to sprout. First clip, please.
It took me so long to write about my American experiences after Red Azalea was because I was living it. I was in the mountain, and I couldn't see the mountain. I felt that I did not know enough about America as I know about China. It took me 29 years of living in America as an immigrant to develop the confidence and to trust my judgment about America. My low moments as an immigrant was when I was taken advantage of. As a newcomer who didn't speak English, I didn't have the common sense that Americans had. I subject myself to vulnerable situations. For example, because of lack of money, I shared a Chicago basement room with a fellow immigrant who raped me. I also made a poor choice in my marriage. My ex-husband was a good man, but was not a man for me. I followed him out of fear of not being able to make it in America and deep loneliness. My high moments was the moment I was granted the green card. I remember breaking down and sobbing on the floor of my attic. And it was just such a joyful moment. I felt safe for the first time. And another moment was when I was giving offered a book contract for Red Azalea. With some of that money, I fulfilled a dream of my mother's in China. I bought him a toilet. My highest moment was, of course, my daughter Lorianne made it to Stanford University. She was my real American dream. Being in America has taught me that I have options in life. In China, when I was growing up, everybody was taught that we were bought on the machine of communism. But here in America, the best gift you can offer is your honest self. The self was a strange concept to me when I landed in America. I would say that I was born in China, but I discovered myself in America. I wouldn't say I have any lessons for Americans. Well, maybe. I think Americans take too much for granted. Kids like my daughter, for example, she refused to walk to school in the rain. And an American TV man, weatherman, would say that a raining day is a bad day. I prayed for raining days back in China in the labor camp. Because only when it rained did we get a break. I'm not talking about average rain. I'm talking about the rain that poured so heavily that the rice shoots we just planted flowed back up. My daughter Lorena was born in Chicago. I'm a survivor. The difference between us as Americans is that my past will never be past. I don't have to miss China because it has never left my mind. Lorianne was raised a princess. She feels entitled to her freedom. For example, when she returned from her kindergarten, she said to me, "Mom, I don't want my tomato to touch my potato." When she returned from Stanford for Thanksgiving, she said to me, "Mom, I don't want to be affiliated with you." I was only allowed to remind her my bottom lines once in a while. What I remind her the most was a Chinese saying, "Di shui zhi en, dang yong quan xiang bao," to repay with a well for a drop of water during drought. I want her to repay America. I wanted her to give back.
Thank you.
I'm going to read a paragraph describing the day I landed. Off the plane, I went in search of the ladies' room. All the signs in English confused me. I followed a woman into a room with a sign showing a lady in a skirt. I was glad that it was the right place. There was no waiting line. I looked around, and to make sure I was where I thought I was, I entered a stall and closed the door. I had never seen such a spacious and clean toilet room. A roll of paper came into view. It was pure white and soft to touch. I wondered how much it would cost. I would not use it if I had to pay. I sat down and pulled the paper a few inches. I looked around and listened. No alarm went off. I was not sure if I was allowed to use the paper. I dragged out a foot more, and then another foot. I put the paper under my nose and smelled a lovely faint scent. Perhaps it was free, I decided. Carefully, I wiped my behind with the paper. It did not scratch my buttocks. What an amazing feeling. I grew up with toilet paper that felt like sandpaper. In fact, it was what I had packed in my suitcase. Toilet paper made of raw straw. I was escorted into a brown-colored room. A lady came. She introduced herself as a translator. She began to speak accented Mandarin. You don't speak any English, but you are here for college. How do you explain that, Miss Min? I had cheated, I told her, and I was guilty. Your paper said that you speak a fluent English, the translator continued. I would guess that you didn't fill out those papers yourself, did you? We need to deport you, Miss Min. I broke down. I came to America because I have no future in China. If there hadn't been so many people in the middle of the night at the Huangpu River, I would have carried out my suicide. I wouldn't be here to bother you. I'm sorry, Miss Min. The translator looked away. I didn't have the fortune to die in China, I cried. I will be as good as dead if you deport me. My airplane ticket alone cost 15 years of my salary. My family is in debt because of me. I'm begging you for an opportunity. Miss Min, you wouldn't be able to function in this country. The translator shook her head. Even if we let you go, you wouldn't be able to survive in American college. Do you understand? You will become a burden on our society. I will be nobody's burden. I don't need much to live. I'm an excellent laborer. I would deport myself if I don't speak English in 3 months. Miss Min, oh please, my feet are on American soil. I might not be able to communicate, but I can draw. I will make people understand me. Look here, my pictures, my paintings. I'm going to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. The translator went back to the immigration officer and they had a discussion and they discovered that in my paper there's a clause and it says that upon the arrival of this student, if her English was not sufficient enough, she would be sent to an English intensive English program at the University of Illinois in Circle Campus, where I would be given 6 months to master English and pass the orientation examination and go back to the Art Institute. If I fail that test, the school that issued me the I-20 would be responsible for report this case back to immigration for my deportation. And I thought, 6 months, I only asked for 3 months. I bet you would master Chinese in 3 months if you were in my shoes. Next clip, Andy, please.
It is now 16 minutes before 9 o'clock. It is not uncommon on this broadcast for us to have guests who have taken unlikely paths to get here. But I dare say no guest has ever traveled a more unlikely road than Anchi Min. 20 years ago, she was a peasant. laboring in the fields of Mao's China. She was a dedicated communist who faced a lifetime of lonely labor in those fields. But through an amazing set of circumstances, she is here, living in the United States. She has written a book about her story. It is called Red Azalea. And An Chi Minh is joining us this morning. It is a pleasure to have you here. I say it is such an unlikely story because at 17 years old, right, you were hauled away from your family, sent out to the farms to labor as a peasant, right?
Yes.
And you were, at that point, a member of the Little Red Guard, raised on Mao's teachings, fully believing in those teachings.
Yes.
Can you remember a time when you began to doubt those teachings?
Well, the first moment was when I brought to denounce my teacher. It shocked me. And people around me was praising me, and I went home. My mother said she wants to disown me because she said, I'm a teacher too. Can you imagine my student do that to me?
Now, that was before you got sent to the fields. You were told to denounce one of your teachers as a member of the Red Guard, and you did that.
Yeah, it was the challenge just to be able to tear myself from the one that I love.
Then you went to the fields, were laboring there. The harshness of that labor and the conditions that you went in, working, what, 5 in the morning to 9 at night, did you say?
Yeah.
The harshness of those conditions, did that make you question what you were doing?
Yeah. After a year, and I see the field doesn't grow anything, but I tried to cope with it because all my other comrades were doing, you know, bearing the same tough life, and didn't seem too abnormal about it.
Then what is literally a million to one shot, some scouts show up to find movie stars. They wanted peasants as movie stars?
They wanted to have a working class face.
And they chose you as one of those?
They picked me when I was hewing the cotton fields. Went on the competition.
And then all
times.
Of a sudden you go through 6 competitions, and all of a sudden you're out of the fields and in Shanghai trying to become a movie star. I mean, that the culture shock of going through that strikes me is just amazing. In that time,
people often ask me how I started writing and why I wrote what I wrote. And I picked this paragraph and I thought it could serve as a pretty good explanation. When my daughter Lorianne was a year and a half old, I took her to the Bridgeport Neighborhood Park in Chicago for her first swing. It was a lovely spring day, and the sun was bright, and the trees were budding with new leaves. The park was nearly empty. A group of teenage boys was sitting on the fence, chatting among themselves. Lorianne was laughing on the swing. She had rarely been out since birth. She was chubby and didn't like to move. Her favorite thing to do was to sit with her father on the couch and watch TV. Her grandma told me that Lorianne was not fat enough. "It's a sign of ill health," she warned me. After my in-laws applied the Peking duck feeding style, Lorianne gained weight. Her belly was so big that she earned the nickname Buddha. It was impossible to zip her clothes in the front. All the buttons had popped. What concerned me was Lorianne's cough. She had a cold that she seemed incapable of getting rid of. Every photo I took of her, there was snot dripping from her nose. Lorianne's laughter made my heart sing. As I pushed the swing, I thought, she will soon learn to say, "I love you, Mom," and "I love you, Pop." Instead, "I love you, Chairman Mao," and "I love you, the Communist Party of China." I was proud of myself for being able to provide her a safe place. I loved the part of American culture in which children were adored and celebrated. Lorianne was fortunate. I would not let her forget where her mother had come from and what life could have been for her. It made me smile to imagine that my daughter would get sick of me saying when I was in China. I would insist that she serve America when she grew up. She had been given so much, a much to be expected from her. "Are you Chinese?" I heard a tender voice calling behind me. It was a white boy about 10 years old. "Are you Chinese?" he repeated. "Yes, I am," I returned his smile. "They," the boy pointed at the three boy, white teenage boys sitting on the fence. "They asked me to ask you if they can fuck you." I was stunned. I looked at the boy and said, "Did I hear you say the F word?" "Yes, you did. Fuck you." I stood speechless. The boy ran toward the teenage boys. The group received him and patted him on the back. I wished that I could erase that memory. There must have been a reason these children did what they did. They must have been influenced or taught hatred. They hated Chinese because they did not know Chinese. I remember how I was taught to hate Americans as a child. The time when my mind was locked in a permanent sunless winter. I believed that Americans were the source of evil. It was because I did not know Americans. Suddenly, I was fearful of the environment Loyang would grow up in. I would not be able to sew her into my pocket in order to protect her. I removed Loyang from the swing and started to walk home. It was during that walk I realized my calling. Instantly, I knew what I would do for the rest of my life. I wanted to introduce China and its people to Americans. My soon-to-be published books might serve as grout between bricks. I would help defrost ice in the hearts of Americans. My favorite author is Frank McCourt. How many of you read Frank McCourt? Oh, almost every one of you. That's great. I just so much wish that I could write it like him. I had the fortune to be panel with him one day in Chicago. I was very excited, and we came out, and we were briefly introduced to each other, and three people. Frank McCourt sit on the right, and there's a lady from Chicago's projects sitting in the middle, and I sit on the left. The topic was what it was like to live in poverty. So the woman from Chicago, she's American, and she started first. She complained about how terrible her life was, and she only had two toilets. And it was really, she just feels so terrible that how could she be treated this way, only two toilets. And for some reason, that word toilet just touched a nerve on Frank McCourt, and I saw him just turn around. He says, "Don't get me started on toilet." I didn't have a toilet. I had a bucket. Now, every one of you read the Angelus Ashes, you know where the bucket was. It was at the corner of the staircase when they came down, and that's where everybody go do their business, and even in the middle of the night. And the stink just came to his room, and it was so awful to live with that day in and day out. And when Frank finished, then it was my turn, and I said, "Don't get me start on the toilet." I didn't even have a bucket. I had a manure pit, and I have to perform this Chinese acrobat performance on the manure pit. Do you know what it's like? We're rice farmers, and we dig a pit and put a wood board about 2x4 on top of it, and it's slippery all the time. And the hardest thing was not about the trick about squatting on it. The hardest thing was to deal with the mosquitoes. There are super mosquitoes in the rice paddy, the southern part of China, and it's just hundreds and thousands of them. And it's a bit easier when I do my small business. I just squat and use my hand as fan the mosquito, keep it away. I just go like this. And these are super mosquitoes, and they can bite through my canvas thick work clothes. But when I was doing my big business, and then thousands of mosquitoes, a bond, one gets successful and come and bit me, and the instant itch was so hard to bear, and I would stop doing that, just scratch myself, and I would lose my balance. And down there is a millions of maggots. After I finished, I turn around, and I saw Frank McCourt turn around, and we look at each other, and the lady in the middle just got up and disappeared. Next clip, please.
The self-worthlessness was so deeply ingrained in me by my culture and society that I prayed for a boy when I was pregnant. I didn't want a daughter. I wanted to secure my child the respect and privilege it deserved. I didn't want my daughter's life to mirror mine. It was surprising given the fact that I was born and raised in communist China and we promoted women's liberation. I didn't realize that my core value was corrupted. I cried at Loria's birth, because born as a female meant a tougher life. The only thing I could do to prepare her as a mother was to make her a fighter.
I know that my mom has said that when I was born, she cried because I wasn't a boy. And that doesn't make me angry or upset. What it really means to me is that she's such a grounded person, that she saw all the suffering, all the inequality that she had to experience as a woman, and she cried because I think she wanted to somehow protect me from all those struggles that she saw were ahead for me.
Truth is always beautiful, no matter how hurtful and ugly. Fallen and getting bruised is part of standing up and staying tall.
I think that even though I came from a divorced family, I was very lucky. I had a very happy childhood. In general, I think I just was a very happy kid. And part of that stemmed from the fact that I knew that my mom really cared about me and loved me and would go to the ends of the earth for me.
She's born in Chicago, but she's also a child of a new immigrant. She had to help.
I think I was pretty happy as a kid. I was mischievous and happy. I have good memories.
On her birthday, instead of taking her to Disneyland, I took her to Home Depot. My gift to her was a lesson on how to use power saw and a book titled Plumbing 123. I made up my mind to always share the truth with Lorianne. I think it's important that she has a sense of reality. We watch Snow White together. Then afterwards, I tell her that one day my prince will come. Did not happen to me. I failed my marriage. I had a failed marriage.
I also learned how to believe in myself.
I couldn't afford to pay Loria piano lessons, so she never had one. She learned to play piano on her own from YouTube. You'll notice when she plays, there's no music notes in front of her because she did not know how to read the notes. But she plays beautifully. I believe that one would become magical when one is making one's best effort.
Loyan and I were on letters. We had been repairing a ceiling damaged from a bathtub leak on the second floor. We had taken down the old soaked ceiling drywall and were trying to replace it with the new sheet. We were having difficulty lifting the drywall sheet into place. The weight was crushing us and my strength was falling. I asked Lorianne, who was standing on the ladder, to hold up the drywall by using her head as a stabilizer. I grabbed my drill and climbed back onto the ladder, driving in the screws. I started to fasten the drywall onto the ceiling joists. My arm was shaking. Loyan was losing her strength. "Almost there," I cried. "Bite your teeth and push the drywall up, Loyan. Harder. Push all the way." She was in tears as I drove the last screws in. I examined Loyan afterward. The protective adult-sized glasses had fallen from her little face. Neither Home Depot, Ace, nor Orchard Hardware carried child-sized protective glasses. "Can I take glasses off now?" Loyan asked. "Not yet," I replied. "We have more to do, and dust can get into your eyes." After we finished taping the drywall joints and spreading the compound over the tape, our legs and arms were so sore that it hurt to move. I took off my daughter's shower cap, bent down, and kissed her little dust-coated face. I'm jumping forward, and this happened in one of my early time. And people often ask, how did you pull through? How did you survive? And looking back, I think it's a rely on a lot of kindness of strangers, of Americans, when they reached out to me, I think that gave me a sense of self-value that I meant something. And this is one of the incidents. "You don't sound okay," Stella said as she picked up the phone. I told her that there had been an emergency. I asked if she would come and pick me up at the corner of Wallace and 26th Street by the bus stop. "I'm on my way," Stella said. I waited by the payphone booth, trembling and freezing. The snowflake came down like white feathers. In my icy socks, I couldn't feel my toes. An hour later, Stella's car pulled up. She opened the passenger door and let me in. "What's going on?" I broke down sobbing. She discovered the bruise on my neck. "Oh my God, you've been strangled. Who the hell?" "Your roommate?" I nodded. "Did you call 911? Stella asked. "No, why not? Would you like me to call 911 for you?" I shook my head. "Don't be afraid. This is America. He has no right to do this to you." I let Stella know that I wanted no trouble. "Auntie Min, for God's sake, that son of a bitch just strangled you." "I know." "He could have murdered you. What's wrong with you, acting like it was your fault? I'm driving you to the police station." Next clip, please.
"I dare not dream the American dream. I didn't think it would apply to an underdog like me. It'd be too much for me to ask. I just wanted to serve and earn an opportunity to exist."
"Used experiences that were extremely painful. And I just came out of a women's international health class at Stanford, where I learned a lot about the struggles women in developing countries and immigrant women and women really around the world, what are the major issues that they're struggling with. And in my mom, I see a lot of how she went through those struggles and she survived. And what that said to me was, my mom has a platform.
What I revealed in The Cooked Seed might possibly affect my family in negative ways. Whatever that's done wrong to a woman was considered a woman's fault throughout the history of China. Silence was expected from such a woman. Her obligation toward her family was to hide the truth. Part of becoming an American was to challenge that, to break away from my own roots, to tell the truth without guilt, shame, or self-punishment. I feel that I owe that to my daughter. So far, so good. Nothing helps speed up a child's maturity more than witnessing her mother's failures and struggles in crisis. Loyan was forced to live my reality. I hadn't meant to involve her, a young girl at her tender age. Though in my heart, I had no regrets. I felt that it was the best thing that could have happened to her. She learned to respect reality. American children are the happiest children in the world. Most of them are sheltered from everything bad and cruel. The future to most of them was rosy-colored. I would rather have the shit hit Loyan's fan now so that she would have the time to develop coping skills. I felt a great sense of achievement when I heard her say, "Mom, there will always be bad apples. You just have to recognize them." Unfortunately, my happiness did not last. A week later, Mrs. Luang wanted to cut my pay. She said that she had made a mistake. She would no longer pay me by the piece. Instead, she wanted to switch to paying me by the hour. $4 per hour, the same as I paid the Korean girl. "Do you expect me to paint one flower for each hour?" I was upset. "No," she replied. "I expect the same productivity, 6 pieces or more per hour." "For $4 instead of 14? "That's correct. But take it or leave it," Mrs. Luang said coldly. This was the first time I had witnessed capitalism at work. "You expect me to produce 6 pieces for $4, which comes out to only 66 cents per piece. You told me that the Korean girl made 1 piece per hour, and she got paid for $4, and me only 66 cents? "You are faster. You still earn $4 per hour by painting 6 pieces." I argued that transportation costs me money and time, and I skipped lunch, and I skipped my toilet time. I tried not to drink water, and it would not be worth it at the end of the day since I would only make $5. Mrs. Luan said that it was not her trouble and that she had no intention of making my trouble hers. For the rest of the day, I painted 6 pieces an hour for $4. I netted $8.50 total for that day. I tried not to feel disappointed as I sat on the last subway train returning to Chicago, but I couldn't help myself. I was exhausted and hungry. My hand clenched the 8 $1 bills and 2 quarters. Next clip, please.
Flowers on women's lingerie for 50 cents per piece. It's my graveyard shift. I would start right after I return from a waitressing job in a Chinese restaurant. And I would start from painting from midnight till 3 a.m. Today, painting is my hobby. I loved it when my daughter Lorianne decorated her Stanford dorm room with my paintings.
Part of the immigrant experience is its loneliness and deep isolation. It drove a normal person into illness, odd behavior, and madness. Like an uprooted tree, it goes into a period of shock. I lived in desperation, despair, and was wrapped in helplessness and hopelessness. I did not fear the hardship. I feared the permanence of it. This next clip, I try to portray the inner struggle of an immigrant. And I wrote this, the paragraph that was this film was about. It's about try to tear myself away from the old self and try to have courage. Lying awake at night, I ask myself the question, who are you, An Ji-min? If I ever had a chance to learn what it means to stay positive, it was now. I did not yet know the American I was becoming, but I was sure that I was no longer the same An Ji from China. I, who was defeated, was refusing to accept the defeat. I was broken, yet standing determinedly erect. I could be crushed, but I would not be conquered. And that, I concluded, was who I truly was, who I would be. Next paragraph is about how my American-born daughters start to rebel. I had her under my palm for only so long. Back in the car, I tried to discuss the idea of milking the system with Lo Yan. Mom, don't start. Lo Yan's voice was confrontational. I don't feel like having a discussion, not right now. Since Lo Yan's birth, I had been preaching the philosophy that the only way to achieve the American dream was by hard work. Unfortunately, Lo Yan had seen with her own eyes the opposite. I must know what's on your mind, I said. You wouldn't like it, Mom. I must know. It's not the end of the world being poor, okay? It's supposed to be the end, and it is. The impression you have gotten here is wrong. This is a particular and a peculiar case, and not all poor people live like this. I mean, not in a normal situation. You can't tell from one spot that it is a leper. Mom, don't try to fix me or anybody else. I mean it. I'm afraid that you're getting the wrong impression. I don't think so. You're not seeing the whole truth, Lo Yan. You know what I see, Mom? I see the freedom Jamaica's kids have. The true freedom. The freedom you came to America for. The freedom I don't have. I see that Jamaica's kids have a normal childhood. They don't have to carry 30 pounds of concrete bags day in, day out. They don't have to clean other people's toilets and sewage and end up getting the stink in their hair that even a bottle of shampoo can't get rid of. Jamaica's kids wear clean clothes, have weekends and friends, and are happy. Lo Yan broke down. I don't think I'm asking too much. I really don't. A strange face slowly entered my mind. It was a description by Margaret Ross from her novel, The Lover. Cry out to crack the ice in which the whole scene was fatally freezing. My mother turned her head. I found myself calm. My mind was coping. It was responding in an awareness, knowing its options, including my own confusion and the lack of strategies. Never before had I been so clear about the state of my mind. There was something unfamiliar, something exquisitely American taking place. You have to read the book to know that. I would like to end tonight's presentation with the next clip, the final clip. I had nothing but gratitude when I was putting the images together. America did not just offer me the opportunity, but also my child. As we are now Americans ourselves, we will cherish America's greatness by offering ourselves. Andy, next clip.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, always a moving presentation by Anchi, man. Jeez. We've got time. We're running late, so we've got time for about 15 minutes worth of questions. So, if you have a question, Anchi will point you out. We'll get a microphone to you. Sir?
You've written many books, and this one is about your experience as an immigrant.
Yes.
But right now in America, we're trying to decide what to do with 10 million immigrants. Should we send them all back to where they came from? Should we punish their children for coming here illegally and not let them go to college? Should we have a real strict way of making them citizens? Say, make it 10 years and let them pay back money because they didn't pay their old taxes. How does it strike you, these arguments?
Well, I think my view is very limited. In my view, this is what I told my daughter, unless you contribute, you don't deserve to live here. This is a beautiful country built before we entered. So if you can't, or you don't, I have such trouble with people milk the system, period. So I might be politically incorrect. Thank you. Next, please.
Do you ever go back to China, or do you have any urge to go back?
I go back to China, and it's for personal reasons, because I got divorced, so I feel that I owe Lorian a lot, if I can. And I was a single mother for 7 years, and it's important that I establish her relationship with her grandparents from the other side. So for the 18 years, I brought her back every year. And my mother-in-law's opinion of me was important. And especially for she said to me when we were divorced, and she says, as a woman, I am on your side, but I'm Chiku's mother. I can only take my son's side. And I appreciate for that understanding. So I get to China every year. And also, I couldn't afford Chinese language schools here for Lorian. So she goes to China, bond with her grandparents and learning Chinese at the same time. Also, I wanted to keep in touch, know China's pause, so I will be reporting back to America with accuracy. And I feel that so much about China is being, to put in the best, like as misinformed. You know, I think America lack of understanding of China, and we can't no longer afford that. China has become our partner and rival. And I will still use that Probuck's words as she spoke in 1967. You know Probuck? Yeah. She's my hero, and she was, I following her footsteps. She said in 1967, she says, how China and American relationship, it depends on America's decision. It's up to Americans. And the interviewer says, how so? And she says, our behavior would affect how the China's reaction, and China can be wonderful friend and frightful enemy. And China, it's not easy for China. China, I think, I understand, coming from China, I know how it panics. Like it's, when it presents to the world, it wants a perfect image. It will not, China refused to give you any reason to demonize it. And it backfired. When you see the Olympic 2008, you see the perfect moves. It's scary. But it's China did everything. And it's like through my book, it's what I struggle as a Chinese. It's like after 25 years, I know material. I know the power of it. But how far would I take this material and to expose the dark side? And we underestimate American readers, Americans, and that you actually see that as a human, that you have the dark side. And the projecting your dark side is not necessary, will serve you in a negative way. And China would not understand that. So China tried to proceed this perfect image, which is totally fake. And the more Americans get that kind of information, the more it gets suspicious. And the gap just grows bigger and bigger with the misunderstanding. And so I set the goal that I want all my books to be entertaining because I see how China's classics fail to become your bestsellers. It never got a chance. So I adopted the way of storytelling from like Gone with the Wind. And I tell you the story, but in the meantime, I want you to walk away with solid knowledge of China. So that was my difficulty in the mission. And as I understand how American, the culture works, I feel a more and more freedom I have. I went off the topic, sorry. And next, you, please.
Your discussion tonight was very inspiring, and the fact is you talked about that word liberty and freedom. In 1989, what happened at Tiananmen Square really touched the world. I have two friends who were at Tiananmen Square on that day. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on what happened in 1989 and the dreams that many of those young people had from China, that one day they will rule China themselves under the word democracy and freedom.
Mm-hmm. Let me question you. Do you think China will be where it is today in prosperity and everything if the students took over? You see?
I can't answer that question.
Right.
But
I just wanted to think about it. It's tricky.
But I find that from working with scholars in higher education, many of them from China who are now professors in the United States, they're very upset with those young people from China in 1989, and I still don't understand why.
Because
Liberty was about freedom.
Right. Why were they upset? They're upset about that. My heart was with them, and I think that it's the passion of the student want to make China better. I mean, that's very idealistic, but I do have problems because when I went to back, I actually went back to support the movement. And I was asked to join the hunger demonstration from the Tiananmen. And I found that the person who invited me, who was the leader of a Shanghai University, used to be a Red Guard. We're from the same school. He was an opportunist. And you think about the details. All the student leaders got their visa, passport, ahead of time, before the shooting. Now how you, as a leaders, you left it, and they shouted, said to the rest of the student body, we need blood. The world needs to see blood. And where you have your own visa, already on the American fly, how do you live with yourself? Next question, please. Yeah.
This is not a question. I just want to say, that presentation that you did with the reading and the film, I don't think anybody fell asleep. I think that was
marvelous.
I'll tell you, that was a marvelous.
Thank you. I have to thank the director, Andy, for the platform, for giving me the opportunity. Thank you. Next question, please.
Do the Chinese still revere Mao? If so,
why in view of the history of the Cultural Revolution? And if not, why is his picture all over the place?
Good question. Why Chinese? How do Chinese view Mao? Well, you see, it's tricky again. We all, from China, we know that what Mao did, right? But the founding father, the communist founding father, if you put Mao down, that means you denounce your own value. And in the eyes of people, you are not, the foundation was rot to begin with. So they just couldn't help it. They just have to put his face on the Tiananmen Square. But what they did was practicing Deng Xiaoping's view, which is white cat, black cat, whichever catches the mice is a good cat. So that's what the Chinese, and it's the agreement with between people and the government. As long as you let me build my toilets, you let me live, you let me have my job, you can put up Mao's face there. Just everybody, just they have all kinds of name for Mao's coffin laying in the middle of Tiananmen Square. But I understand the Communist Party's concerns because it's, you know, stability. And I think the education level for Chinese peasants, if you open the door for the Chinese come here, we don't have this take and give. If there's something to take free, we're just going to take. And that's what really concerns me. And that's what China needs to really improve on that, the education. Next question to her. Yes.
Hi. I would just like to say that I really enjoy your writing. I started with The Last Empress and mm-hmm. Empress Orchid. I like just devoured the books. So I would like to say thank you for writing them and also for bringing such a memorable platform to learn about the history and the culture. I would like to ask you, besides, you know, being a woman yourself, like what inspired you to write about Empress Orchid and to show the world her story, and what inspires you to just continue on writing besides your own personal experience?
It's my love for America. It's my desire to pay back. It's when I see what you're lacking, what you need. For example, many of my Americans talk about, try to understand the China system. For example, how the Mao's prosecuted, murdered millions of Chinese during the Cultural Revolution. How could you prosecute Mao? That in America, the leader in the West, the leader announced there's a war. And after war, if it's a wrong war, Hitler, whoever, you can hold somebody responsible. You have the documents. And the moment that he announced the war. In China, it doesn't work that way. For example, when Mao, you can never nail down Mao. Mao never said a word about murdering people or start a cultural revolution. And this is what he would say. And Chinese have no problem comprehending it. But you have no idea. This is how Mao would start. I give you an idea. Mao was threatened. You see, 1949, he took over China. And he tried to compete with Russia, with America, and he couldn't manage the country. Henry Kissinger was right. Mao was a good revolutionary, but Mao was a lousy manager. And he started the great leap forward and tried to make China, bring up the China's productivity by ordering the nation to cook the steel in the backyard. And in my own family, my sister was 2 years old and she could not stand. And one day my mom asked the nannies, what have you been feeding my daughter? And she says, water. My mother said, why? I gave you the coupons, the rice coupons. Where would the rice coupon went? And the nanny says, I was sent it to my village, they're starving. And eventually my mother could not afford the nanny anymore, let her go. And this is something my mother really regretted because she went back and she poisoned her entire family and her own life. It's because of what Mao did, the great leap forward, starvation. And then the nation was in chaos and the vice president, Deng Xiaoping and Liu Shaoqi, they came and tried to fix Mao's mistake. And they did. The problem was that the nation started thinking that Mao cannot manage. The vice presidents, they are actually should have the job. But when the worship of Mao started to shake, Mao started to panic. And it was then he started, you see, China started to recover in 1960s. And then we made an enemy with Russia. And the nation was going through, recovering. And it was when Mao feel that his position was threatened. So in 1963, Mao started to plot the Cultural Revolution. And 1964, it's the fire, the wildfire starts, the Red Guards. And then before the Red Guards, Mao took a group of the secretary and the important people to have a camp hiking in the mountain. On top of mountain, just to visit this pagoda. This pagoda had a 999 Buddha statues carved on the face of this pagoda. And Mao went up there, and he says, I wonder, what made the three generations of sculptors, stone carvers, take such a dangerous position and carve these sculptures? And they might fall, they might as well fall and died. What was it that drives them? Oh, it's the fear of falling. And with each Buddha statue they carved, they are secured, they gain the insurance, they feel blessed and protected. And it was then Mao's assistant understood that Mao was in fear of his political opponents. Mao was ready for the Cultural Revolution. Then they took that hint, went and started to support the Cultural Revolution, started to have the students light the fire in the students. And students just roared the whole nation. We start to denounce teachers. And this is how whole thing start, the murdering, for 12 years. And you can't nail Mao. He just praised the pagoda. It's a beautiful pagoda with Buddha statues. Anyway, next question, please. Last one.
Please tell me about Tibet. China's position, your view of China, China's claiming Tibet, and whether you agree with that or not.
Tibet, I personally just like Dalai Lama so much, but I'm the wrong person to ask this question, because I grew up being brainwashed by the Communist Party that Tibet belong to us, and everything about Tibet was my vision, was the Communist Party's vision. And the only thing I knew was that my neighbor, I give you a story, my neighbor was a Shanghai, the best elementary school teachers, and she was ordered to go to Tibet to serve. So teachers in China, the elementary school teachers in Shanghai, they are afraid to become the best. Because once you became the best, you're sent to Tibet. So it's pretty confusing messages. So I'm sorry, I don't really know how to answer your question. And that's all for tonight. Thanks for coming. I'll sign your books.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.